Today's talk is given by Professor Bob Barr, OBE, of Manchester Geomatics, and also at the University of Liverpool. And his talk is entitled, Ask Not What the PDC Can Do for GI, Ask What GI Can Do for the PDC. I'll not spoil his talk other than to say perhaps that PDC is the new Public Data Corporation initiative, recent initiative by the UK government. Professor Barr's interests include social information systems, analysis, visualization, social and spatial information, policy issues, and strategic reuse of service information. He was awarded an OBE for services to geography in 2008, and is also actively involved in urban regeneration and provision of affordable housing in Cheshire. So, over to Bob.
Great, thank you very much indeed for the introduction. And it's very, very nice to be back in Edinburgh. I always like coming back to Edinburgh. It's been a treat. I've been externally examining here for the last couple of years, which means I get to Edinburgh for my birthday. And given that I was born just a few hundred yards across on the edge of the meadows, actually, it wasn't the Simpson Memorial Maternity Hospital. It wasn't actually on the edge of the meadows. It's nice to be able to, on my birthday, walk around my birthplace. I'm sure there's some astrological significance to that. So it's very nice to be here, and thank you for the kind welcome. I was just saying to Bruce that I can hardly think of a more exciting time to be here than now. We're suddenly going through a whole range of revolutions. Yes, we're going through an economic crisis, and that's what we hear about in the newspapers all the time and on TV all the time. But if you didn't read the newspapers and didn't read the TV, you'd imagine that you were going, certainly in the geospatial world, through an incredible boom. That suddenly the technology that we want to use has become incredibly affordable and incredibly powerful. And at the moment, over the last few days, almost every day, a new tablet computer is being launched at a lower and lower price. You might be aware of the fact that Amazon have launched a Kindle 7-inch tablet, which is going to cost $200 in the United States. Now, these are computing devices with the power of perhaps hundreds of times the power of the workstations on which we were doing GIS in the 1980s. And we thought that in the 1980s we just about got there, and we hadn't. Even something as silly as an iPod Touch is many, many times more powerful than workstations. But these devices are completely useless without data. So the other revolution that we're going through is sometimes called ubiquitous computing or super connectivity, but now we can be connected almost wherever we are. I mean, I haven't connected to the Wi-Fi here, but I'm finding, certainly, I don't own an iPhone, but I do own an iPod Touch, that I'm very, very seldom away from a Wi-Fi hotspot. Which means not only do I have the computational power to deal with geographical information here, I've got geographical information potentially on tap all the time. So I went to the OpenStreetMap conference in Denver a few weeks ago, and one of the freebies was just a little application, literally being given away for free at the time, and it was a street map of Denver. You won't be able to see it, but anyone who wants to take a look at it afterwards can see it. You think, okay, that's fine. We've seen street maps quite often. We look at Google Earth, we look at these raster images, pictures of maps coming up on the screen, tiles, all very well. Well, the odd thing about this one is, I can spin it if I want to, because it's not a picture. It's vectors that are being processed in there. The labels move around, so every street is always labeled on the screen. If I want a perspective view, I pull two fingers down and I get a perspective view. More important than that, if I want to know where the bus stops are there. If I want to know what the timetables are there, the timetables are there. Wasn't working in Denver, but there's no reason why it shouldn't work. And if I want to know where the next bus is going to come, I can press the bus stop, and not bother looking up at the sign of the bus stop when it hasn't got one, and be told when the next bus is going to come. So suddenly, we're living in a world of massive connectivity, almost ubiquitous computing power, and all of that requires data in order to be able to run it or to do anything sensible or anything useful with it. And David Rhind, GI pioneer in the UK, very much a leader of the GI community, for much of his career, and then absconded to the Ordnance Survey, where, having said for many years the data should be free, spent 10 years, or slightly less than that, explaining why data was an extremely expensive commodity and why one should trade in data in order to cover one's costs, and is now chairman of the Advisory Panel on Public Sector Information, recommending to the government again that data should be free. So it's interesting the way that things are turning. So in addition to the technology, the technological background that we're dealing with, we're going through a period that we go through round about every 10 years, and my old physics teacher told me, you know you're getting old when you see things coming around for the third time, of a massive discussion as to how we fund data, where data comes from, who should own it, who should be able to sell data. And that's why the new coalition government has come along with this concept of a public data corporation. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to resolve a lot of the issues that have existed around public sector information over recent years. And the main issues around public sector information were, if it's free, how do you fund it? If it's not free, who should pay for it? And how do you make sure they pay? And how do you protect the asset so that people pay? So how do you stick it behind paywalls? And the Public Data Corporation is trying to change that picture in some ways, and we won't really know quite how it's going to change it for a matter of months to come. But at the moment, we're in the middle of a consultation, or in fact two consultations from government. One is a government consultation on open data, that is that the government is very keen to give data away. Unfortunately, the data the government is keen to give away are the salaries of all our top civil servants. Mildly interesting, but once you found out that Vanessa Lawrence earns £200,000 a year, it ceases to be particularly exciting. They're also enormously keen on the fact that local authorities now publish every item expenditure over £500. But actually, if you look at them, they're the world's most boring spreadsheets, because if you try to get any intelligence out of them, they're almost useless, because they don't code things up in the same way, they don't code the organisations, and they don't geocode the organisations that provide the service, so you can't even answer the question, are we shopping locally or are we shopping further away? They don't tell you which ward, and I as a councillor am quite interested for how much of that money was actually spent on my residence. So there's an awful lot of raw data being thrown out, but not an awful lot of information. And the Public Data Corporation is something that can change that, because it will also deal not just with that raw data, those individual transactions, but with the reference data that's necessary in order to make those transactions meaningful. So suddenly we've got a massive government agenda that's right back in our field. So why the title? Why not ask not what the Public Data Corporation can do for GI? Because we as a community should not be going out and saying, this is what we want. We should say, look, we've been at this game for about 20 years. We've been involved in data wars of various sorts, and I've been here and spoken before about the data wars in GI. We know what doesn't work. We might not quite know what works, but we certainly know what doesn't work, and we can make suggestions as to what sort of models we can come up with for the provision of data that might just work, and that's really what this talk is about. So I'm going to talk briefly about what the Public Data Corporation is, why it might be important, but most of the talk is about the sorts of principles that I would like to see government taking account of when deciding how the Public Data Corporation should work. The Public Data Corporation was released to the world as a concept, actually, by Charles Arthur and Michael Cross, The Guardian, who are sufficiently nerdish to read things like cabinet office business plans. One of the things that the coalition did when they came in May of last year is they were very concerned that government should become more businesslike. So they sent out a template to every government department of about 10, 20 pages and saying, we want you to fill this in so we know what the business plan is. And lo and behold, buried deep in the Cabinet Office's business plan was work with the Department of Business Innovation and Skills and Her Majesty's Treasury to create a public data corporation. We looked around and said, what's a public data corporation? And there were no more hints there as to what a public data corporation might be. And then work with the shareholder executive to drive the release of core reference data for free reuse from the Public Data Corporation. Now, that was really quite strange, because
the geographical community, or certainly the Associated Geographic Information, has been engaging with the shareholder executives the last 4 or 5 years, because we've been very concerned that chief executives of shareholder executive have gone public and said, we're there to line up the trading funds for sale. And then they got moved on, and the next chief executive came on shareholder executive. Actually, everything they said suggested that that was fundamentally what the shareholder executive was about. The shareholder executive looks after the PLCs, the businesses that we own nationally, but businesses which are now not governmental departments, non-governmental, sometimes called non-departmental bodies, but those which have been operating in a quasi-commercial way as trading funds, or Royal Mail has been operating as a PLC, and their main ambition has been to sell them off. And earlier last year, or no, 2 years ago, Ordnance Survey's business plan certainly appeared to be a roadmap to privatisation. I was invited along to that launch, and I spoke to one of the directors, and I said, absolutely fine, no problem, sell off Ordnance Survey by all means, but what you can't walk off with are monopolies for core reference data, because there's no way of controlling that monopoly. There won't be a level playing field, so you won't be competing fairly with the rest of the sector. So you leave behind the factual reference data and you take the rest away. He said, we can't possibly do that. I said, why not? He said, because it strips away 80% of the value of the corporation. So there was a strong suspicion already that the shareholder executive was there actually to sell off our national assets. It's not, I think King James was the last monarch to sell monopolies in order to fund the national purse. But that looked as though it was what the shareholder executive was about. And suddenly, the shareholder executive are being told they've got to drive the release of free data, which was completely counterintuitive. The other thing which was a pig-might-fly aspiration was the Public Data Corporation was going to be created by April of this year. They are talking about April of next year, mind you, and they have identified three bodies which will be part of the Public Data Corporation. And the three bodies are really rather odd. They're Ordnance Survey, the Land Registry, and the Met Office. So they are now all run from the Department of Business Innovation and Skills, and all three of those are potentially parts of Public Data Corporation. I've had the good fortune, the bad fortune, to talk to ministers about this, and we were asked for a briefing paper, and we described the Public Data Corporation as a policy without a plan. Well, Oliver Letwin liked that. He said, that's absolutely right. You've got it dead right. That's what the Public Data Corporation is, a policy without a plan. Can you give us a plan? I hope these are the beginnings of a plan, because it's not one which I expect them to accept. So, the public relations is all about the Public Data Corporation being there to free up public data and drive innovation. And this is the mission. The corporation will, for the first time, bring together government bodies and data into one organisation. Now that, I think, is potentially a very, very good idea. Because what we've got is ludicrous duplication across government. So we have multiple government departments collecting very similar data sets. All the civil servants are not surprisingly saying, you don't understand, our job is quite different. So in England and Wales, the Land Registry says that registering land parcels against Ordnance Survey maps is a completely different job from creating the maps in the first place. And the Valuation Office says, no, all we do is work out what tax should be paid on these. We aren't really bothered about parcels, we want identified through textual identifiers. And Ordnance Survey says, no, we just go out and do objective mapping of the natural environment. In practice, an experiment is going on in Northern Ireland where those three functions are being merged. Now, I may well be wrong, it may well be that those are three separate functions, but it doesn't strike me as being right that the chief executives of those individual organisations should be the ones that advise government as to whether they should be merged or not. Which is why a public data corporation or some body that looks at government information from the point of view of what does government need to fulfil its public tasks, rather than asking departments what do you want, might not be a bad idea. However, the next bit is supporting the government's growth agenda. It will open up opportunities for innovative developers, businesses and members of the public to generate social and economic growth through the use of data.
Now, this has been up before, round about the turn of the millennium, when the Labour government was a relatively new government. The Treasury was looking at stimulating growth through releasing data. There was a whole use of non-knowledge initiative. And that's always slipped off the agenda when push has come to shove. And I fear that it's happening again. And now, if you talk to people from Ordnance Survey, what they will say is, great, we've released the open data, now where are the groundbreaking projects? Where's the growth in the economy that is a result of the data we've released? And to be fair, it's very, very difficult actually to identify how opening up some Ordnance Survey data has made things any easier. There's also a transparency board. The transparency board looks at other aspects of the government's agenda. Economic growth is only one reason why the government's looking at data. They're much more interested in accountability, citizen choice, and transparency, on shining a spotlight on how government works. However, the shareholder executive reports to the Transparency Board, and at the March meeting, they came along and they said, this is what PDC will do, to provide a more consistent approach towards access to and accessibility of public sector information, which is fine, same as it was before, making more data free at the point of use. However, there's a slight sting in the tail, and consistent with ensuring value for taxpayers' money. And now that is a very, very important one, because in the past, when organisations were funded to generate data, the Treasury was always suspicious that organisations like Ordnance Survey, when they were simply funded from a central purse, were producing a Rolls-Royce when a Vauxhall would have done. And this issue of getting value for taxpayers' money for data is absolutely critical. The second one is motherhood and apple pie, really. It's the PDC will create a centre of excellence driving further efficiencies in the public sector. I don't really know what that means, other than it doesn't make sense to duplicate activities. So, for example, of the three agencies that are already lined up for being part of the PDC, one thing that the Land Registry and Ordnance Survey would need to do is share data centres. And it makes sense to share technology. There's clearly a shared services agenda going there. But the most worrying one was the third one, which is pure shareholder executive speak, which is that the public data corporation would facilitate or create a vehicle that can attract private investment. Ah, hang on. You want to sell them a survey, don't you? Yes, it looks as though they might want to sell them a survey. But if you start thinking about what's the problem with getting private investment, the problem you get private investment in, then the whole balance of things changes because your responsibility is no longer to the nation as a whole, it's to your investors. And all companies are set up to maximise shareholder value. And suddenly, if you've got privileged shareholders, i.e. the private investors in national data bodies, then we aren't all shareholders as we are when they're government-owned PLCs, but there's a privileged set of shareholders to whom those organisations are going to have to respond. So at the moment, and this was presented in March, the shareholder executive was supposed to come back to the Transparency Board in July, and as far as I know, they haven't as yet. Still, a policy without a plan. I'll skip that. So let's think about what the Public Data Corporation mission should be. Actually, there's quite a nice mission statement knocking around already. And that's the mission statement of the Association for Geographic Information. The mission of the AGI is to maximise the use of geographic information for the benefit of the citizen, good governance and commerce. Actually, that was a very AGI statement. We only put in good governance and commerce to satisfy our corporate members because good governance should benefit the citizen and commerce should benefit the citizen, but doesn't always. So why shouldn't that also be the mission of the Public Data Corporation? To maximise the use of government information for the benefit of citizens, good governance and commerce. And I think that we will be testing the success of the PDC on that basis. I said that when you get old you start realising that these things are coming around again. Well, lo and behold, we had the cross-cutting review of the knowledge economy, a review of government information which came after a review of Crown copyright. As I said, when the Labour government was fairly new in the late 1990s, and this came in 2000. Now, this was the last time
that the tectonic plates moved. In 2000, you may find it unbelievable. I look back and can hardly believe it. Ordnance Survey had been ordered under David Rhind to start recovering their costs, and Ordnance Survey actually were doing very well by that stage. They'd moved their cost recovery up from about 30% of their costs to over 80%, and David was promising that they'd get to 100%. Ordnance Survey's cost recovery, depends whether you think it's real or not, but Ordnance Survey's cost recovery now exceeds 100%. It provides a dividend to the Treasury, and the Treasury quite likes that. The dear old Office for National Statistics, the Office of Population, Census and Surveys, as it was in those days, was very well-meaning but thoroughly incompetent at recovering its costs. I can't remember what the figure was, but it never got to 20% of its costs. And in order to get to 20% of its costs, they were doing completely bizarre things. They were going out and taking a census every 10 years, but then they had to recover some costs. So how could they recover costs? They could only recover costs by taking the census data and locking it away. And they made an arrangement with people called census agents who had to pay £20,000 a throw, a lot of money in the year 2000, in order to be able to distribute census data. Well, of course, once they'd done a deal with the census agents, OPCS couldn't give the census data away. So I found myself teaching on courses for civil servants who were doing social research. And I remember being up in Sheffield, and some of the Department of Work and Pensions said, we've just carried out a survey, which cost us £10,000, and we need denominators for that survey to find out what the percentages are. It's going to cost us another £10,000, which we haven't got in the budget, to buy the census data in order to make sense of the research that we've just done. Isn't it a nonsense? Well, good old Tricia Hewitt said, it is a complete nonsense, and said, we're not expecting OPCS and ONS to recover their costs anymore, and they can place their results and the data in the public domain. And that has made an enormous difference, and that has actually gone on to initiatives like Neighbourhood Statistics, which means that vast amounts of statistical data are available free at the point of use. Quite oddly, actually, not everybody in ONS has quite understood this. So you go for certain data sets and you say, yeah, it's absolutely free at the point of use, there's a £200 handling charge. You say, what? And yeah, it's absolutely free at the point of use, you can have it whenever you like, but you have to put in an application saying that you want it. I say, what bit of open data don't you understand? What you do is you stick it on your server and you allow people to download it. And they haven't quite got there with all of their data, but they are getting there. So it can take them 11 years. So we ended up with the Berlin Wall. And ideally, we would like to knock down the Berlin Wall, but we can't. And this Berlin Wall had Ordnance Survey on the one side, very glossy, very nice, very well funded, but only for the rich, as West Berlin. And there was a danger that on the other side of the Berlin Wall, there was open and free data, but all sorts of impediments to using it, and all sorts of cost restrictions in how you maintained it and produced it. And we've been fighting about what should be which side of that Berlin Wall of data ever since. And the reason the discussions about the Public Data Corporation are exciting is that I can't see it being a 1980s destruction of the Berlin Wall, but I think the alignment and what goes each side of it is very much up for play. And I think the other thing that has to be concerned about, and it's why I also like the Berlin Wall analogy, is that both sides of the Berlin Wall thought they had the best deal. But at the end of the day, the free data side, the East German, everybody gets equal access. Yes, but you get access often to a very poor and underfunded resource. And we've seen that in the States. Yes, there has been a free data initiative in the States, but the departments that generate that data have constantly lost funding. On the other side of the wall, you have potentially the world's best data. The only problem is that you can only afford it, you can only use it, or have access to it if you can afford it. And what we're trying to find is some sort of halfway house between those two divides, the Berlin Wall. This was one of the low spots on the side of the Berlin Wall. On this occasion, it's quite interesting because historically, all the machine guns stopping people from getting out were on the eastern side of the wall. In terms of the data wars, all the machine guns stopping people from getting out were on the western side of the wall.
and the biggest machine guns belonged to the Ordnance Survey. The AA, after the Ordnance Survey, was the biggest mapping organisation in the country. They produced road atlases of various sorts and a whole range of atlases. And they came to the conclusion that their atlases simply were not competitive, were not a sensible price, were not a price that they aspired to sell them at if they had to pay OS copyright. So, the taxpayers already paid for producing a national street map, but the most popular motorist support agency in the country thinks that they're being asked too much to pay for it. So they said, fine, we'll do it ourselves. And they got out of copyright Ordnance Survey mapping, they got aerial photography, they put inertial guidance, the predecessors to GPS systems, into some of their vans, and they put together this big publicity about how they were going out and recapturing their own Ordnance Survey copyright-free street map. There was only one slight problem about that. The slight problem about that was, allegedly, without the knowledge of senior management or without the knowledge of the board, there were people within the AA mapping department who were cutting corners. And, unfortunately, Ordnance Survey identified the corners that they were cutting by overlaying Ordnance Survey mapping on AA mapping and identifying areas where the Ordnance Survey mapping was known not to be absolutely accurate. There was a lovely statement from Vanessa, who had just become Director General then, about how they had fingerprints. These weren't things that affected the quality of the map, but were things that absolutely allowed us to identify what was Ordnance Survey mapping. Rubbish. They were errors in Ordnance Survey maps, but happened miraculously also to appear in AA maps. And the case went to court. It was an enormous cause celeb. The courts were enormously unimpressed because ultimately it looked as though the AA witnesses were perjuring themselves because Ordnance Survey could prove that someone had lifted data. The AA said, no, it wasn't us. And in the end, management said, no, it must have been some of us. Centrica, another household name, because bear in mind, what's the AA? The AA represents 10 million motorists, the taxpayers. Centrica, wonderful private sector company. They just happen to have the monopoly for the national grid for gas. So they've got their hands in every taxpayer's pocket as well, every gas user's pocket. And in order to settle the case, ultimately the case was settled out of court, Centrica paid Ordnance Survey the largest copyright damages ever awarded in this country of £20 million for having lifted some of the street mapping. So that, after that case, inevitably Ordnance Survey were very powerfully established on the western side of the wall, and they had the full power of the law, and what's more, the full power of the courts behind them in order to impose it. There was the other little course level when they did something very silly about the cover of a book in Scotland, didn't they, last year, which I think they finally gave it, which just looked like an Ordnance Survey map, wasn't even a copy of an Ordnance Survey map, but that's by the by. So protecting their intellectual property is absolutely crucial to them. You might ask, how is this relevant to the PDC? It's relevant to the PDC because the shareholder executive are concerned with the things that give those assets value. And it's that false scarcity that gives those assets value. However, things can change, and I wish I had the other photograph. I haven't got the other photograph, but I must dig it out. I'll tell you what the other photograph looks like. Tuesday the 17th of November 2009, breakfast meeting in number 10. The inventor of the World Wide Web, Tim Berners-Lee, Nigel Chadbolt, Open Data and Web proselytizer from Southampton, Martha Lane Fox, one of the founders of lastminute.com and now one of the government's digital champions, and a PM desperately in need of a popular gesture. So what do? They turned up in the morning and they said, we're going to give away data as part of making public data public project. We will order Ordnance Survey to give away certain data from their house. Whether it was the right data is a moot point, and I would argue that it probably wasn't. Had Ordnance Survey been properly informed of this? No, they hadn't. Where was the Director General of Ordnance Survey? The Director General of Ordnance Survey was in Chile organising a coup, or at least having photographs taken that looked as though she was organising a coup, because there were photographs appearing on the International Cartographic Association website and on various social media of three generals in enormous white uniforms with the world's biggest epaulettes, and Colonel Lawrence standing in the middle, not in her full military uniform, but nevertheless looking as though she would like to. And she got this appalling phone call to say that the Prime Minister just told us to give our data away. So it was just part of that war. So suddenly the pendulum looked as though it was swinging massively to open data. That was good news. The bad news was the Ordnance Survey was not given a mechanism for funding it, and actually there is some short-term funding, but the short-term funding is amongst the worst possible funding. It's simply a block grant to make the open data available. And that's not going to last. And inevitably that's not going to last. And one's tried to work with these block grants in the past, so they haven't worked there. So Ordnance Survey is saying, look, if you want open data, make sure that the Treasury can see where the receipts are coming from. At the moment, they can't. So, what is it from a geographical point of view that we want from the PDC? Well, my view is that, yes, I do want some free data, but I want that free data to be sustainable, and I want it to be justifiable, and I want there to be income streams that will pay for that free data. And actually, that doesn't mean giving away the topographic mappings, giving away... I don't mind Ordnance Survey giving away some topographic mapping, but I'm not so concerned because there are alternative sources of topographic mapping. Also, topographic mapping cannot be definitive. Now, when I use the word definitive here, what I mean is something that only has one correct version. So, if you think about a definitive data set, Royal Mail's postcodes are definitive. Nobody else can invent a postcode and it be valid. That's only organisation, and if you want to know what your postcode is, only place you can guarantee it is by going on the Royal Mail's website and checking on their postcode checker. They're allowing you to check 15 in a day, and that is a cut of the database from the previous night. That is the only valid, real, formal version of a postcode. Car number plates should be definitive, except for the ones which are forged, but nevertheless, as they're simply forged, you can have forgeries of definitive. So my view is that we should concentrate on data which is definitive, which there only be one version. Why should we concentrate on that? Because that's data that from a national point of view should be collected and maintained once and used many times. So definitive data is a fact. It's either a fact because someone has said this is the postcode for this area, or it's a fact because if people go out and collect the data again, they'll collect the same data. And that's why I come back to the AA case. Because the AA case is interesting. What the argument was about was the street map. Now, we have a phenomenal initiative at the moment, which is the Open Street Map Foundation and Open Street Map itself. An Open Street Map is a quite unbelievable success internationally. An idea came about 5 years ago. Steve Coast, at that time an undergraduate student at University College London, I discovered recently that Steve Coast never finished his degree at UC. He's now working at Microsoft. He's one of the great non-graduators working at Microsoft. Now, many countries are mapped better on OpenStreetMap than they are in their official sources. And certainly in large parts of countries, the quality of the mapping is as good in the best areas as it is from official sources. In some areas, better and more complete. And the issue there is that should the names of streets be definitive data? The answer is, it's an absolute pain when they aren't, and yes, they should be. Someone actually, it turns out to be the local authorities in the organisation, can decide what a street is called. They might put the nameplates up accurately, they might not. But there doesn't seem to be an awful lot of point in me as a taxpayer having to pay for the AA to go out and decide what the streets are called, for Navtec and Teleatlas, the commercial suppliers, one of those now buys from Ordnance Survey, the other one doesn't, to decide what the streets are called, for Google to go around producing street maps, for Ordnance Survey to go around producing street maps, and because none of those are available at a price I'm prepared to pay, ultimately relying on a bunch of volunteers on bicycles and GPSs to produce a street map which is fit for purpose. So it strikes me that if one's looking at examples of geographical core reference data, then the street map is a very good example of that. Of course, that if you decide that it should be collected and maintained once and used many times, it becomes a natural monopoly. Well, the problem with the monopoly is there's no fair price for it, because you can't have a market price because there's no supply, there's no variety of supply, there's only one supplier. And
the other problem with such data is it has variable value in different applications.
And the same thing applies to things like a postcode. A postcode has minimal value, but some value when you're sending a letter, because it gets a letter to its destination. But if a postcode is used by a bank to identify credit card fraud, for example, by looking at relationship transactions, it has massive value. Likewise, you might think that the location of a street can't have variable value, but the answer is yes, it does. If you're having a heart attack, the ambulance driver having the right street name for where you're going is enormously valuable to you. If you're just on your trip to local Indian looking for a street name, then the value is very, very small. The values vary enormously. But we need core reference geographies, and we should identify that these should not be captured and dominated by single suppliers. So they're variable value, and they have highly elastic demand. That means that if you change the price, the amount that's used changes enormously. And the problem is that if you want to recover the costs of geographical data collection, then the easiest way to do it is to set the prices high and only sell to the highest value users. And the problem then is, if you try to cut your prices, those high value users will either want a price cut themselves, in which case your revenue goes down, or you start reducing your income. So that's a real problem. Unfortunately, organisations like Audience Survey, but many geographical data sets, are potentially core reference geographies. Inspire has come up with a series of candidates for what should be the core reference geographies. I'm not going to go through these in detail, but geodetic framework. We're all relying on GPS. In order for GPS to be accurate, you need to know exactly what the lat long is of certain fixed points. Now, many countries are simply placing that in public domain. Other countries are trying to sell access to the underlying geodetic framework. My view is that's a core reference that should be centrally funded. Topographic mapping, including height. An awful lot of the argument has been about topographic mapping, including height, yet I don't believe you can have a definitive topographic map. I think that even if you have a specification for an Ordnance Survey map, and in fact I've been invited out, having said this a few weeks ago, Ordnance Survey immediately said, have you ever been out with one of our surveyors? Our surveyors always get exactly the same results regardless of which surveyor we send out. I'm not sure I believe that. I don't think there can be definitive topographic mapping. I think that it is always going to have some element of subjectivity and error in it. Likewise, height. And what's interesting is that there's a commercial competition for height, for geographic height data, because there are various different resolutions, there are various different ways of collecting height data, and different height data sets available for different purposes. Geographic names. Well, my view is that geographic names should be definitive. I find that a little bit difficult in Edinburgh, and I'm sure that Bruce will give you good reasons why they shouldn't be, but it's quite interesting going to Roslyn and Roslyn Chapel, because they always seem to have a competition in Roslyn for the maximum number of different ways of spelling and presenting the name of the location. Alternative names are entirely fine. If you don't have a set geographic name, a set geographic name that avoids ambiguity, then you end up with problems. And the English examples of those problems was when the deprivation scores for Kingston upon Hull were allocated to Kingston in Surrey, the deprivation scores for Richmond and Yorkshire were allocated to Richmond in Surrey, and the best of all, when the Department for Communities and Local Government sent £3 million to Newcastle-under-Lyme, when they had intended to send it to Newcastle upon Tyne. Newcastle-under-Lyme Council rather smartly banked it and said nothing. Having banked it for 2 years and said nothing, and no one having asked them anything about it, they spent it. And CLG then discovered that they actually had an issue. But having a definitive set of names and codes, and this is something that we're moving towards and is going to become open data. Addresses, my view, should be definitive. Streets, I've already said. Land and property ownership, I won't get into the cadastral issue, but again, should be. Not at all convinced about hydrology and hydrography, but it's not an area I'm an expert in. Statistical boundaries should be. Administrative boundaries should be, because that's the way the government is telling the people where they live from a military point of view.
All sorts of funding issues. ONS now use government click use licences. All of the surveys work through full cost recovery through trading, and land registry's got a mixed dissemination cost and market price. Really odd about that. Thanks to some protests from Scotland, because house price data has always been freely available in Scotland, one of the great open data successes in England and Wales has been forcing the land registry to release house price data, that's the price paid in housing transactions, effectively for free. It's at a very, very low cost. That's the good news. The bad news is that Land Registry have digitised all the property parcels for an index map of property in the UK, but the prices they charge for the property parcels are so ridiculously high that for local authorities, housing agencies, many other organisations, it makes more sense to recapture the parcel data than to buy it from Land Registry. So you can have a free model, a full cost recovery model, or a mixed model. And I think that mixed models are going to become much more the norm. Consequences, you end up with aspects of data wars. There was an interesting battle recently between the Association of Centres of Distributors, who filed a complaint with the Office of Public Sector Information against the survey. And the reason for that was that ONS released the output area boundaries into the public domain. These are sort of Thiessen polygon areas, which are now the standard unit for census output in England and Wales, but these were nested within ward boundaries, which was great. Except the problem was, the Ordnance Survey said, hang on, we've made these ward boundaries available to be part of the whole data set, but we are not making them available for commercial use. So you can get the free data set from ONS, but you can't dissolve out the internal boundaries and leave the wards, because that's our commercial copyright. Well, the Association of Census Distributors, surprisingly, still exist because they no longer have their favoured deals from the Office of National Statistics, but it shows that actually commercial value-added distributors can carry on working even in a free data and open data environment. They put in a complaint against the Ordnance Survey saying this is ridiculous, this is public domain data now, and they lost the case. And OPSI accepted that the rules for Ordnance Survey were that they have to recover their costs. And if they have to do irrational things to recover their costs, so be it, said OPSI. Words to that effect, they might disagree with me. The result was the Ordnance Survey business model, and also the key point, an admission of cross-subsidy. And this is why this is so, so difficult. Because people talk about Ordnance Survey, about the National Mapping Agency having a public task. Now, a public task is something that the citizens expect government to do. And the trouble is that Ordnance Survey doesn't deliver any service directly to citizens. So it's perfectly clear what the police's public task is. It's to catch criminals and prevent crime. It's perfectly clear what the fire service's public task is. It's to go out and fight fires. You know what the Treasury has to do. It has to collect taxes. So you know what the Valuation Office's public task is. It's got to identify the property which is taxable. So there are public tasks which require particular sets of data, but a mapping agency, which is working as a trading fund, has no public task. The problem is that certain bits of government paid Ordnance Survey, so for example the Boundary Commission pays Ordnance Survey to create and maintain the boundaries. We think, hang on, that's been done for the Boundary Commission. The Boundary Commission has an obligation to tell the public where the boundaries are. Surely that data set should be in the public domain. But no, it isn't. It's actually a for sale data set, or was until Gordon Brown liberated it, from Ordnance Survey. So there's always been an argument that Ordnance Survey have had it both ways, the National Mapping Agencies have had it both ways, that there's a cross-subsidy, that they're getting privileged access to funds to carry out a public task, which they're then using to compete unfairly with other potential suppliers of aerial photography, height data, topographic mapping, street mapping, and goodness knows what else. And people say, well, hang on, if it's a trading fund and it's supposed to operate as a business, it should operate on a fair level playing field with all its competitors. If it isn't, if it's an organisation that's carrying out public tasks, then it should do so, but it should be paid on a fee-for-service basis. It shouldn't be paid money because it, quote, owns the data. So, what can the Public Data Corporation learn from data wars? If we don't learn from history, we're doomed to repeat it. Geographic information has been subject to continued acrimonious data wars, as I hope I've demonstrated in just a few examples. So, are there any principles we can extract from this history? And I think there are, and I hope the people who are going to be responding to the consultation of Public Data Corporation at least take some of these on board. The first one is the government should only collect and maintain data which is required to deliver a specific policy objective. So the answer is that there isn't a lot of cash out there, but there is data that's absolutely necessary for government to do its job. And that's data that would be collected whether it was made available for reuse or not. And in order to comply with Principle 1, you need to identify what that is, and you need to identify those specific public tasks. Government data should normally be definitive. That's collected once, maintained in a single place, with only one correct version. Didn't make sense, but actually made a lot of sense for our companies, spun out of the University of Manchester, that there were three address bases running up to the census in 2011. There was Royal Mail's PATH, there was a value-added and value-degraded version of PATH that came from Modern Survey in the performance address point, and there was a completely separate address base that came from local government, a National Land Property Gazetteer. As it turned out, it was quite good for us, because none of the three were fit for the purpose of conducting the 2011 census. So the work we were given over the last 3 or 4 years was to bring those together into a single dwellings register. And what ONS were looking for was a guarantee that at least 99% of all dwellings, all occupied spaces, would be there. And it looks as though we succeeded in doing that. But there is an awful lot of duplication going on out there, and a lot of duplication going on within government. Bearing in mind, I've already said definitive government data creates a natural monopoly, and there's no market mechanism setting that price. Any price restricts reuse, and that's absolutely key, both due to the cost and often largely to the overheads of license administration. That's one of the things that's really problematic, that in order for the Ordnance Survey to keep their tanks lined up on the western side of the Berlin Wall, they have to have an army of people who write impenetrable licenses, an army of lawyers that defend those licenses, an army of people marketing the data just in order to give it some sort of value out in the marketplace, and all of that effort is designed to prevent data getting out, creating artificial scarcity, and therefore giving value to the rest. I don't think it makes sense. Principle 3. Wherever possible, data should be used for multiple purposes across government. And this is where different government departments at the moment keep saying they want their own. Well, in the States they don't allow that, although I wouldn't use the States as a very good example. But there's something called the Circular A130 from the Office of Management and Budget in the States, which stipulates that no government department may invest in a data set until it has demonstrated that no other government data set can be reused. And by contrast, in the UK, there are at least 4 mutually inconsistent property registers. I mean, it's just... doesn't make sense. And that means that there has to be a locus in government somewhere that looks at how information, including geographic information, is handled in government. By default, unless there's a privacy consideration confirmed independently by the Information Commissioner, all government data sets should be made freely available in a raw form through data.gov, as timely managed as possible. Where possible, in real time, rather than according to publishing schedule. Data distributed through this channel will be as is, without quality assurance or kind mark. Publishers want quality assured data, authenticated provenance, which should be licensed from Public Data Corporation. Now, this really worries a lot of civil servants. A lot of civil servants are worried that there is data that is imperfect that they use to carry out their tasks, which is quite right. You have to have data which is good enough. But if they release that, there is a danger of knock-on consequences. Well, Tim Berners-Lee stands under the banner of raw data now. And actually, Francis Moore, the Cabinet Office Minister, is also standing behind that banner of raw data now. So what could a Public Data Corporation be? I think it could be a value-adding intermediary between government and data publishers who want to reuse government data. So it wouldn't actually sell, it would simply make sure the government departments handled their data needs properly and then make that data available. And I'm not sure we actually need a PDC. I think what we need is a regulatory office of government information. possibly including the functions of the Employment Commissioner and some of the OGC. And in fact, there is such an office in the US government. Part of the Office of Management and Budget is an Office of Information and Regulation, which does precisely that. It identifies what data is required to deliver the public task and ensures that it's collected only once. So, one of the things that we need to be able to do is to identify the fact that organisations like Ordnance Survey actually have three parts to them. One is the data registry. That, if you like, is the section that decides what definitive data sets are needed for what purposes and how they can be made available. And that strikes me as being an operation that has to remain within government. The second bit is data factory. Well, organisations like to argue that they've got very special IT skills or very special surveying skills or very special skills of one sort or another that can only be maintained if they're subsidised by a data registry and other activities. I simply don't believe that's true. I think that data processing, and particularly now that we're getting cloud-based data processing, has become an increasingly generic activity. And Peter Dale and others have argued even 20, 30 years ago that Ordnance Survey ought not to employ surveyors, that it ought to be district surveyors that either use independent surveyors or local authority surveyors to work to a specification rather than having a dedicated data factory. And the third bit is the bit that Ordnance Survey makes its money out of, which I was told off because I called it the casino, but it's the casino end of data supply. That what you do is you capture some data from the data registry, you hold it hostage, and then you sell it to the highest bidder. Well, it strikes me that it's quite right that the public sector has been arguing against that, and the public sector has been saying that's not good enough. So if you could take organisations and separate out, at least in accounting terms, the data registry work, the data factory work, and especially the publishing work, then you'd understand how they work a lot better. And actually, privatising either the data factory or the speculative publishing house isn't really a problem, so long as there's a level playing field in terms of how the data registry is maintained. So to conclude, I think that most of the issues being raised by Public Data Corporation have been encountered with other geographic information initiatives. I'm afraid I'm old enough to have seen that we've been there before. But the good thing about having been there before is actually we know directions we don't want to go, and we know certain things won't work. We don't necessarily know what will work, but we know what won't work, and we should avoid going down those routes again. We know why those have failed. If we do the same, it's naive not to expect the same outcome. If you don't learn from history, history will repeat itself. So I think that these initiatives we've got at the moment are really exciting because they do offer an important opportunity to do things differently this time. And I think that the PDC should concentrate on the public interest and minimal intervention. It should be a very lightweight body. It should handle only data that's essential for government. And it should concentrate, as I said, only on definitive data. And it should be funded sustainably by charges, mainly by charges for change, not charges for use. I can go back to that later on. And it's quite likely regulated. Alternatively, you could have several public data corporations which take on trading activities of the trading funds, but would be regulated to have no privileged access to government data and benefit from no uncontrolled monopolies. Now, the reason the shareholders actually don't like that is they don't see how that stacks up. But I'm sorry, that's the competitive world of real business. If you want it to play shop, there's got to play shop fairly. If you don't want it to play shop, turn it into a government registry. And I think that the data factory and the publishing services can be provided commercially on a level playing field. And my view is that actually you can probably do without a PDC if you have a public data registrar who's responsible for open data regulation and monitoring how government uses data and how it procures data. That's it. Thank you very much indeed for your attention.
I see one question. Start with William.
I was a bit surprised by your talk because the title of it was Think Not What You Do. And I thought that you were going to talk about what the general public could contribute to the BDC.
Ah.
And so then I had in my mind it was all about people in the street capturing pictures of their own land, use stereoscopic smartphones, you alluded to the quality of OSM. And yet, in all of your principles, not once did any of those principles mention the potential contribution of the general public. So I assume it would be your view that that's just a completely different activity.
Not
And that you're not scared that the PDC would be made irrelevant by institutions such as, if you call it that, OSM, and publicly generated data.
I think that the impact of crowdsourcing and publicly generated data is that it has destroyed the mystique that existed around the commercially available data. However, I felt slightly embarrassed. I've been to every OpenStreetMap conference except the first one. The first one was held in Manchester in the building next to the building where I worked in the university. And the reason that I didn't go to the first OpenStreetMap conference was that I wasn't completely signed up to the principle. There were lots of very nice, enthusiastic, bearded people in sandals, very similar to my liberal friends, on bicycles with GPSs, rushing around Manchester trying to recreate something that already existed. Whereas most of my work and much of what I'm talking about here is about liberating what already exists. So I think that destroying that mystique will do that. However, I think that from a citizen point of view, it's only if some of this formal data is released for public use that some of the other aspirations of the government in terms of transparency and accountability will start to make sense. At the moment, you need some very, very clever data hackers, mainly in the broadsheet newspapers. But it's very interesting looking at The Guardian, The Telegraph, and The Times, and to some extent the Daily Mail, have been competing in order to produce interesting, newsworthy, often geographical, often mapped graphics that make sense out of the data that's being freely released by government. Now, the thing that stands in the way of that is if you don't have the underlying reference data. And that's why my view is that, yes, that public demand is very important. The fact that the public can add and can add all sorts of things the government actually can't is vital. But I don't want the public wasting their time, or my OpenStreetMap friends wasting their time, simply replicating what's already there but locked up behind that wall. And that's why I think at the moment, because of the arguments around the PDC and open data, those arguments are about getting that government data out into the open in an affordable and financially sustainable way. And what we'll then see is massive citizen effort that will put things on top of that. And I think there are massive issues. I mean, for example, you mentioned earlier that I work in affordable housing. Housing associations now manage, I think, the majority of the social housing stock in the country. Now, housing associations actually are very big users of geographic information in various ways, because not only do they have a large portfolio of properties they have to look after, they have to know where they are, but they're responsible for the neighbourhoods, and they're responsible for many of the social conditions within those neighbourhoods. Because housing associations are, they're all charitable bodies, they're all not-for-profit, but they're treated as non-government, they've been left out of the public sector mapping agreement, which means that local government and government agencies cannot share their maps with housing associations, which are providing a great national social service. Now, housing associations could actually use that sort of citizen effort that you're talking about to enhance those maps in all sorts of ways, to get all sorts of very timely intelligence. But until that initial framework, that skeleton of official mapping, is released and made available, that's not going to happen. So I'm very excited about what you've asked about, but that wasn't what my intention was to talk about today.
My cynical view would be,
Yes, that will happen, and that's part of the price of living in a democracy. There's not much point in voting if voting doesn't change anything, so governments have to be allowed to make those changes. On the other hand, at the moment, we've had exactly that issue. The classic bit of nonsense was when Ordnance Survey asked, I think DEFRA as it was now, I'm sure we'll point out, whether they still needed field numbers, because it'd been a nuisance maintaining field numbers. In the past, every field in the country had been numbered on Ordnance Survey maps. And they said, no, we'll never ever need that. And within a decade, farm subsidies came in. And in order to be able to monitor farm subsidies, what you needed was definitive land parcels with field numbers to which the subsidies could be allocated. And that's why I think that you actually need an Office of Information Regulation for the government, where you've effectively got an independent set of people who advise on what data government departments may need. Now, ultimately, the Treasury and cabinets will want to cut that sometime. We've seen that happening in the States. But simply commercialising it and holding that data behind a paywall doesn't guarantee its continued existence. I think that there are other examples of that. One example of that is that Royal Mail has no interest whatsoever in historic postcodes. Because as far as they're concerned, they don't deliver the mail yesterday, they deliver the mail tomorrow or in 3 weeks' time, whenever. So they simply throw away the postcode record. However, postcodes have been used for a whole set of other purposes. There are lots of addresses and a lot of invalid postcodes appearing in government data sets. Somebody somewhere has got to keep an archive of redundant and past postcodes. Now, it's quite difficult to identify an individual government department that would say, yeah, we will hold up our hands and we'll take responsibility for that. But actually, if you had an Office of Information Regulation, they could look at applications across government and ask the right questions and say, do you have to look back through your historical record? Would you need this? Other departments have got the same problem. This is a data set that will maintain that. But my view is that this isn't a nirvana of free open data and everybody getting what they want when they want. This is actually something that can work within the cost constraints that I expect governments to be working within for the next decade or so. If we go into the two consultations and say we're just all about free data because we think it's really cool, it's not going to work.
Well, as you pointed out, the stuff on open data is just not particularly useful.
That's right.
Really, and if that's part of the government, they think they've opted for publishing their data, but as you say, there's a big gap between data and information.
Can I just add an observation to what Bob has just said about this long-term thing and this archiving thing and all that sort of stuff? As a zoologist, one of the biggest problems we've got in ecology now is that, in terms of things like climate change, the long-term monitoring series that we used to have through government research agencies and all that sort of stuff, all disappeared. In the Thatcher area and all that, when academic institutions went from blue sky, long-term monitoring to customer contractor, and suddenly we did not have the luxury to do that. And you know, one of the reasons that happened was because people were looking at the long-term monitoring of that species and asking the question, has anybody ever used this? And the answer was no. Nobody has ever used this bloody data. Therefore, what we did was we said, well, okay, do we really need it anymore? No, we don't. And then 10 years down the track, suddenly we say, but wait a minute, if only we had that long-term data, we could have tracked climate change. Therefore, objectives change. Decisions are made, at the time. And I'm just worried slightly that... And I agree with everything you said, by the way, but I just wonder whether, knowing government as I do, anybody in government is going to have the wisdom to be able to sit at the right hand of the Prime Minister and adjudicate on the long-term value of any particular thing. Are we searching for nirvana here?
We might be, but I think that one of the things that changed, I started off by saying that the technical environment has changed. So whilst you might not be able to maintain a collection effort, you can archive and leave archives open in the long term, and that has changed. And I think that has changed radically. And also, can someone sit on the right-hand side? A very interesting point in case is the Office of the Information Commissioner, which was originally the Data Protection Office. The Data Protection Office was set up to protect privacy because European legislation said, Human Rights Act, privacy conventions across Europe, you've got to have one. And that was in the Thatcher era. And the last thing they wanted, and certainly the experience of this world, the last thing they wanted was a data protection registrar. So they said, how can we make this really unlikely to work? Well, let's not pay very much. Let's get a very boring person to run it. And let's stick it up in the north somewhere. Yeah, Wilmslow will do. And that's what they did. The problem was that the first data protection registrar they got was actually a phenomenally good administrator and set up on a shoestring a really effective office. They said, damn, that didn't work. How can we downgrade it even further? And they said, right, we'll cut the salary even further and we'll get the salary so low that no man will apply for it and we'll get a woman data protection registrar. And they ended up with Liz France, who was absolutely stunningly effective data protection registrar, who then became information commissioner and extended the role of the information commission. And as a conscience to government and as an adjudicator on data issues, a very small office has actually worked quite effectively across government. And my view is that that's why I keep, and at the moment, OPSI, they've pushed the Office of Public Sector Information out of Admiralty Arch, out of the middle of Whitehall, out to Kew Gardens and National Archives. Basically saying, it doesn't matter. But very, very strangely, OPSI actually is articulating, I have to declare an interest, I'm a member of the Advisory Panel on Public Sector Information, which is under OPSI, but OPSI has swung with the wind and the political wind, but is now beginning to articulate a body of evidence, is beginning to demonstrate that it is able to regulate and to advise within these sorts of areas. And that's why I emphasise something very lightweight regulation that does less rather than more, but takes advantage of the fact that making data accessible, particularly raw data accessible, has suddenly become possible, whereas even 10 years ago, it wasn't.
Agnes again.
It's a little bit of the window here, it's sort of a complex environment out there, and your sort of contention that topography is somehow not an essential, what people would class as a base reference, core reference data. I think it's incredibly difficult in the urban environment to separate topography from streets and from properties. Because that's fundamentally what people are using it for, to find their way around this sort of landscape. Does it say, well, no, actually, topography is just the height.
I'm not dismissing topography, and the interesting thing about topography is an awful lot of topography has come into the public domain, effectively. I mean, if you talk to people on the omnibuses outside, they will, and you tell them Google Maps is not open data, it's all proprietary data, and you can't do anything with it. The answer is, if you want topography, at least universal access to aerial photography gives you some of that. What you then need is something that references that, which is, if you like, the label layer, or at least the skeleton layer, which the street map is. So there's no advantages to having the street map captured many times, but you can render a whole set of different views of topography within that framework. And whilst what you may well have is you may well identify that government departments say, yes, we do need topography and we need the standards to order surveys doing it, and we're prepared to pay for it out of these budgets supported by these activities. And that's fine, because that topography would then become open, but it wouldn't be definitive.
What always strikes me is all this stuff on your iPhone and things like that, actually, all this data is kind of, all the definitions of what is a topography data set and what is typography are all just dissolving. And really what we want is information about where I am and what I am looking at right
now.
My little iPhone can now give me that, can hold it up and it knows what it's looking at. And that's really what people actually want. And therefore data collector and the data regulation framework and all that should actually be organised to reflect that and how the data is collected.
Okay. You may very well be right. I think you might be right is that's why people say Google's done the job. You've just got a picture of it all, and it's all there. Whereas I come from the tradition that Mike Goodchild came up with this extremely inelegant phrase of the geographic information bearing object, which is something that you can capture from the environment, you can digitise a point, line or an area, you can identify and to which you can give attributes. Now, there's a difference between topography, which is simply a picture of what's there, or simply a subjective, or sometimes more objective classification of what's there. But that is completely open-ended. One of the things that OpenStreetMap is open-ended is what OpenStreetMappers are putting inside the streets. And you'll find some areas where they get enormously excited. OpenStreetMappers will map every tree, every bush, every bit of a footpath, every seat, because they're really excited by a multifarious set of objects within the topography and identifying what's happening between the streets. A second part of the argument is that if you load official street maps into OpenStreetMap, you'll have undermined the whole project because the excitement of cycling up and down the streets and capturing the data will have gone away. And what I've suggested is actually, no, the streets are the boring skeleton that should only be captured once. The various views of topography is what really excites people. But it excites people in very many different ways, which is why you can't... Government might fund some bits of it because they are essential for part of the public task, but it's unlikely to fund all of the topographic data. And then what happens if you give an unfair advantage to one topographic mapping agency, such as Ordnance Survey? It means that their mapping gets dominance over UK map, over a whole series of other potential views of topography. And that's why I distinguish the subjective, varied stuff, which is really interesting, what turns people on, and the really quite boring skeleton framework, which is what I'd like to see collected once and made available. And that's what gives you the reference to what you're looking at within the topography.
I'd like to think that the highway agency had a definitive geographic data set of street furniture and streets and trees and things like that. You'd like to hope.
You would like to hope. Don't even take me there. I've had so many. Department for Transport are very proud of the fact that they're only responsible for trunk roads, so the rest of the street network's nothing to do with them, and the National Street Gazetteer is none of their business. And I quite like some regulators to say, sorry, folks, you're wrong.
I think that, sorry, the business keys, the fact that it's about managing people who own these assets, they need geographic information to manage these assets properly. But coincidentally, that is good geographic information set for other folk that might be interested in. But think about buses, for example. In Edinburgh, we've now got all these lovely digital times up by the bus stops that are telling you how long before the next bus is due. Unfortunately, only for LRT buses, only for Edinburgh buses, not for light first buses. As well, unfortunately, you think, well, actually, surely somebody somewhere who regulates buses needs to know how many buses have actually turned up on time and actually provided the service in order, because there's huge amounts of public money being sent as subsidy to bus companies to run service. And surely somebody, the performance monitoring is a big thing, talking about batch years and that. Surely, you think citizens would assume that there's some sort of performance monitoring data in there, that so instead of, rather than just give you another £30 billion, Mr. First Bus Company, for doing whatever, we'll look at the figures for the last 5 years of the contract and see what percentage actually of your buses turned up in time or whatever. People would assume that information is being collected.
You would. You're absolutely right, except you need a strict regulatory environment to do it. There's one data set which I think is a nice example of that, which there was a requirement, I think there was a requirement, on the telecommunications operators to have a national publicly available data set, database of all the cell phone masts, all mobile telephone masts within the country, lat, long, characteristics of the mast. and such data set existed and it was publicly available. And the regulator was insisting that the data be put into that data set. The telecom operators then went on strike. They said, we're not going to maintain that data set and we're actually going to take it offline. And they said, why? They said, because the principal use of that data set is by people who are objecting to additional telephone masts telling us where else we can put the masts. And it's getting in the way of our business rather than encouraging our business. And actually the regulator caved in. Now my view is that's quite wrong. That's why you need a firm regulator. So if you want your bus performance data, then that's a regulatory activity and the default should be that regulatory data is made publicly available.
There's one final question and then I'll just cut my nose.
And on the cheeky and co-opless occasion to plug something else that's going on. So some of you may know that like basically the government of UK, there are universities in the UK which have tried to publish data. So Southampton's been one of the leaders in this area. So my name's Ewan Klein, I'm from the School of Informatics, and I've been part of an initiative to try and do something similar for Edinburgh. So we have had some input to Principal Strategy Group, and in fact we have had agreement to use data.ed.ac.uk as a portal for publishing data. We don't yet have an infrastructure or a plan or even a policy, but I'm really keen to work with people who are interested in this. And since some of you who are here must be interested in that topic, please get in touch with me. Thank you. Apologies for crossing you off.
All right, I have one more plug, but I should... Well, before we thank Bob, I should just plug our next talk, actually, is on the 14th of October, and is actually from OpenStreetMap, our local representative. I would say something about the coalface, but that would be Dander Hall. So it's actually Craig Miller, so it's possibly grassroots, the grassroots movement. So that should follow on nicely from Bob's talk. And then following that, on the 21st, we actually have Mike Warboys. So we swing from the public to the leading figures in the space of a week. So I'll actually confirm the room that we will probably be in the other room for that, 213. But that will go up the website and the emails. So that remains, one more thing. Tom Armitage is actually here from Medina. So we're getting all the adverts in. They're actually running a workshop on the 29th of November. So anyone who uses Digimap for their research projects or other such like.
Any UK based geographic data, really. Survey, British Georgian survey data. So if you're thinking of using that or using it already, come and grab one of these flyers and we'll have a chat.
So plenty of people to talk to. Thank you all for coming. There should be some refreshments left at the back, some local.
Can I make one point for the new students here? And I think one thing that's really important is that this is something that's going to massively affect your careers, that the nature of GI careers in the past was that many of the work opportunities were limited to organisations that could afford expensive licences for commercial software and that were inside the agreements or were able to afford to buy the commercially available data. What's emerging now is that inexpensive computing environments, whether they're on your own machines or up in the cloud, open source geographical software, which is now coming up to the standards of commercial software. And it was interesting, when I went to the OpenStreetMap conference, the 200 people at the OpenStreetMap conference, there were 900 people attending the free and open software for geospatial conference. And that's an area that's really matured. And the one thing that's been standing in the way for entrepreneurial or not-for-profit or even profitable activity in this area has been access to data. And the tectonic plates of access to data are changing very, very rapidly. So during the year here, I'd strongly advise you to really keep an eye open on what's happening within those three arenas. Because I can't think of a cohort of students who have arrived at a time of quite such radical change, albeit tough economic circumstances, as you have. So, in many respects, I think you're very privileged, but it's a very, very exciting time to be starting a master's course.
With that salient advice, just want to thank the visitors for helping, but thanks once again to Bob for a very engaging, interesting, and topical seminar. Thank you. Thank you. Once you've finished up here, we'll head to the library bar and TV it for the informal discussion.
Another thing.